A new survey suggests Michigan isn't necessarily a big beer-drinking state. Now, it feels strange reporting that from here at the Common Ground Festival, but apparently it's true. New data from the Beer Institute shows Michigan ranks 36th in the country in gallons of beer consumed per adult per year. Only 26 gallons of beer per adult per year. That's just below the national average. I can only wonder how patrons of the Common Ground Festival and fans of Creedence Clearwater Revisited might respond to that news. I think the gauntlet has been laid down. Welcome back to Current State from Common Ground. We got a warm night ahead, and we've dodged some precipitation, and we expect to dodge a little bit more before the evening is through. Among the many music festivals here in the mid-Michigan area, Common Ground is the biggest. Every year in July, thousands flock to Lansing's Riverfront Park to hear acts from a wide variety of genres, rock, blues, country, R&B, hip-hop, and on and on. Here with us now from Common Ground are two of the people at the center of it all. Kevin Meyer is the co-owner of Meridian Entertainment Group, the main coordinator of the festival each year. Hi, Kevin.
Mark, how are you? It's great to be here with you.
It's same back at you here. And joining him is Jenna Meyer, marketing director for Meridian, who also happens to be Kevin's daughter. Hi, Jenna.
Hi, nice to be here as well.
That's great. This is a family affair. What do you do in situations like tonight when the severe weather is a possibility? Do you have to move into a different mode here or what?
Well, as producing outdoor events, Mark, and I've been doing it for a long time,
yeah.
As I think we've known, maybe as long as we've known each other, the technology and the information that's available to us certainly lends some assistance as far as the modern technology, and we're always watching the weather when we do outdoor events where we have large gatherings of people. And as we know here in Michigan, in these kind of hot, humid days, some of these showers pop up, and sometimes they move around us, and then as the sun sets, they cool a little bit. So we're just keeping our eye on everything, and we look for dangerous situations. And I think once in maybe 30 years I've had to evacuate a field during a show, but other than that, usually it all works out.
Was it here in Lansing?
Yeah, if you recall, maybe back at the Michigan Festival, I think it was Mary Chapin Carpenter on Munn Field. We had a real severe storm. It was probably back in the late 80s,
okay.
Early 90s.
Okay.
Yeah. And we had to ask people to take some cover and wait for it to blow by, which is what usually happens, and then we resume the show.
What are your lives like these days during the week of the festival?
Well, the week of the festival is kind of a great time because we get to see all of the hard work we've put in and all of the organization throughout the year culminate in the actual opening of the gates and fans of the festival coming in to see all the music. And
how long do your days get?
Well, they get rather long. I think Jenna can probably lend a little bit on that, but sometimes they're 14 hours, sometimes they're 20 hours, like mine was about a day ago.
For how long leading up to the event are your days longer than average?
Well, usually about 2 to 3 weeks in advance, and let me just say, I've had a lot of coffee in the last couple weeks.
My next question was what your caffeine of choice is.
Oh, so, straight coffee.
Bigby. I see your dad's pounding a Bigby here, as it turns out. Just
yes.
Straight coffee. Seriously, is it it's more hectic in the weeks leading up to the event, or is it more hectic the week of the event?
I think, in a sense, it's more hectic leading up to it. We've got a lot of preparations going into it, and really, once we get to the week of, it's just making sure everything gets executed that we planned and making sure it goes the right way.
It's funny how that works psychologically, because once the moment of reckoning arrives, you feel like there's a limited number of things you can do. It's really out of your hands in a way.
Well, it is, and not unlike what you're doing here, Mark. It is a live show, right? So you prepare as best you can, and then sometimes things happen.
Any last minute fires to put out here last night or tonight? You're nodding your head yes, Jenna.
I think no actual fires, really. Just
no literal
making sure,
fires.
Making sure we got people in the gates, which we did, and everything actually went really well last night. I think for opening night, we had a great crowd. Bare Naked Ladies were great. Ben Folds 5 and Guster, awesome. We have our two other stages, and those went really well last night, also. So,
what are some of the challenges you face throughout the course of the year, Kevin, putting on a festival of this size? I mean, this seems like just a ton of logistics.
Well, I think there's the logistical side, Mark. What we work on a lot earlier in the year and really around the calendar is the programming side. I've been in the talent buying business for nearly 30 years now, and we're always looking at artists that we can bring in for the following festival and the following year. So we make a lot of trips to Nashville and some to LA and New York, and we're always in the talent buying mode. And the talent industry is such that the entertainers have many, many places they can play and lots of people that are willing to pay them to come play those places. So there's great demand for their talent and their art. And part of my process and what I do is trying to get them to come to Mid-Michigan and play at the Common Ground Music Festival.
Does a lot of negotiating go into that, though?
There's negotiating as well as leaving them with the impression after we get them here that this is a great event, we have great audiences, we have very good production, and that word spreads amongst the entertainers in the industry.
Okay.
So that they pass the word to others that, yeah, you should go play Lansing, Michigan at the Common Ground Music Festival.
It's a
great
factor,
event.
That's a factor then.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, Lansing
is.
Will get a buzz from Ben Folds5 or whoever it might be.
Correct. And especially in this day and age with the social media, that word spreads very fast.
We've got a little shower that started to come down here at Adado Riverfront Park, but it will likely blow away here in short order. We've got Creedence Clearwater Revisited on the main stage, and we're visiting with Kevin Meyer and Jenna Meyer of Meridian Entertainment. Talk to me about security. How big of a challenge is that?
Well, as we produce our events, we usually have three cornerstones in mind at our outdoor events, and safety is one of them. Cleanliness is another one, and then we always look for a good value and to put on a good show. When it comes to security, we work with the local authorities in the communities that we produce events in, and we have private security on site as well as typically a presence from the local authorities too, and in this case, the Lansing Police Department.
Jenna, is this something that you want to continue doing as a career, or is this kind of a family affair right now and you're planning on moving on to something else?
Well, I can tell you it definitely started as a family affair, but I love it. I love what I'm doing, and I am so excited to pursue this further as my career, and hopefully we'll get even bigger and more acts to come and more events.
As marketing director, tell us about your day. What is a typical day for a marketing director of a concert, week-long concert event like this?
Well, my typical day is my phone does not leave my side. Pretty much constantly checking
but
social media.
But do you
media.
Answer it? That's my question.
I try as best as I can, but you can only answer so many phone calls in a day. I deal with everything from social media to working with traditional media as well, radio, TV, print, escorting them on site. We also have all of our meet and greets that we do throughout the week, so I help coordinate that as well. Really everything and anything marketing leading up to the festival and during the festival.
Have you learned a lot from your dad?
You know what? I have, and I will never stop learning from him, I don't think.
Common Ground is a public-private partnership between your group, Meridian Entertainment, another private production company in the city of Lansing. Just briefly, why don't you break down how the responsibilities break down? You're in the talent end of it. I think you've made that pretty clear. What about the other two?
Well, I think, Mark, maybe we should reflect for a minute on how Common Ground came about. As you may or may not recall, I think some of your listeners may recall, the Michigan Festival, which was in this market for about 11 years, which was a multiple-day music festival that was held on campus at Michigan State University, went away. And at that point in time, we had done some work at the Michigan Festival for years and recognized that the community had embraced a multiple-day music festival that because of the success the Michigan Festival had, and we thought that it would continue to embrace one. So at that point, we were looking around for venues and for people of interest that would be interested in putting a festival together with us as a partner, and particularly the venues. And we approached at that time the administration in the city of Lansing, which I think was Mayor Hollister, and laid a plan out, and they agreed, looked at it, thought it would be of great benefit to the community, not only economically, but making it a better place to live.
Well, you had some momentum going,
yeah,
right? Which
yeah.
counted for quite a bit, I think, after
right.
11 years of the Michigan
right.
Festival.
And I think people have also said that as the festival grew, and it took 3 to 4 years for the festival to still get some critical mass as far as momentum goes and word of mouth on the street. But once we got to that 3 or 4 year window, the Common Ground Music Festival has done a lot to make the first week of July really kind of the week of the summer in mid-Michigan. We're making it a better place to live while providing a great economic impact to the area as well. Some folks have said it's kind of been a catalyst to maybe some of the development even in downtown. And it also, I think, lends itself to, as we're seeing now in the last couple of years, creating a better place for the younger generation and some of the younger skilled generation that employers of the area are looking to employ.
Kevin, can you explain in any more detail what the city contributes to the festival each year? I'm sure you're probably aware that in last week's City Pulse, there was an article detailing the city's refusal to release documents that outline public spending on Common Ground. Can you shed any light on that for us?
Well, I will defer to them, Mark, as far as to comment on any exact numbers or figures. Obviously, they may have their reasons of why they didn't want to disclose in that particular request, but I will tell you, as a sponsor, I really don't. I've been out of town for 12 days, so I haven't had a chance to talk to
okay.
anybody.
Welcome back.
Thank you. But I do know that they contribute at the beginning and continue to contribute every year in services and in-kind services, okay, to the festival as far as police and fire, okay, and support, which they would do, I believe, for any event and in any sense for something that contributes so greatly to the local economy.
What's your foremost memory of the festival?
My foremost memory of the Common Ground Music Festival, probably the night we had Snoop Dogg on one stage and REO Speedwagon on another stage. That's seriously, I think as a executive producer of events and musical events, I stood on the Shiawassee Street Bridge and I looked at both audiences and I felt that there was a certain passing of the torch going on.
Oh, okay.
You know, from generation to generation. And I recall that there was a little anxiety in the air that we were bringing Snoop Dogg to downtown Lansing. At the end of the night, that anxiety was removed.
I have spoken to a lot of people who have commented on the especially the evolution of the acts in the last few years. Mm-hmm. That's been a conscious aim of yours to really kind of bring in the newer acts?
Yeah, I think we've consciously made a decision. I don't think we did make a conscious decision about 2 years ago to begin to young up the festival a little bit. If we look at the acts that started the festival in the year 2000 and the core audience that was attending at that time, they were basically 30 to 40-year-olds that were attending back in the early 2000s. And that age group is now, of course, 14 years later, older. They look for different things to do, and they're not going to necessarily come out to a multiple-day music festival. In addition to that, those acts, to bring them back now, cost us multiples more than what they cost us back then, and they wouldn't necessarily sell us any more tickets.
Mm-hmm.
So we made a conscious effort to go after the 18 to 34-year-old audience to stay hip and cool, but to really concentrate on putting good sets of music on stage, which is fundamentally what we try to do. You know, let's not put a bad set up there. Let's put some good quality, world-class entertainment on stage.
Jenna, do you get to enjoy the performances here, or are you really on the clock the whole evening?
Well, you know, last night I was pretty much on the clock all evening. I was running around, but that's what happens every opening day. we do get to stop every once in a while and enjoy some of their performances, and I think it's great. We actually like to enjoy looking out at the crowd and seeing what a great time they're having to the performers. So
it is an awful lot of fun. We want to thank you both for joining us here on Current State. Kevin Meyer is the co-owner of Meridian Entertainment Group, one of the main coordinators of the Common Ground Music Festival, which is where we're broadcasting all this week live from Current State, and Jenna Meyer is the festival's marketing coordinator. Thank you both for taking the time to let us broadcast from your great festival. Appreciate it.
Mark, thank you so much for having us, and we're happy you're here.
Thanks, Jenna.
Thank you.
It's Current State here on WKAR. We are live from Odato Riverfront Park, where now the rain has let up a little bit compared to a few minutes ago. Michigan's top education official is calling for dramatic changes to the state schooling landscape. State School Superintendent Mike Flanagan says growing funding deficits, which have led recently to the proposed dissolution of two Michigan school districts, should be addressed by consolidating various local operations into a countywide model. Flanagan says hundreds of millions of dollars could be saved by streamlining transportation, food services, and other responsibilities. He says the savings could then be spent on instruction. However, the superintendent's proposal, which he sent to key state legislators on Monday, is triggering some concern over job losses, erosion of local control, and possible unintended consequences. Earlier today, I sat down with State Superintendent Flanagan to discuss the proposal. He says the response so far from the state capitol has been positive.
Well, the legislature and the Snyder administration have been great. They know we need to make some changes, and they're open to these kind of discussions. If you read the papers this morning, I mean, a lot of the folks in the field are concerned. And, you know, I'm worried about this because from my point of view, I've been given the chore now as of last week of dissolving districts. That's like capital punishment. So to me, we've got to get out ahead of this. There's 50 districts in deficit. And one way to do it is find other economies of scale so that you're not going to have these districts just drifting more and more like Buena Vista and Inkster and other districts that are lining up. So, you know, I've been a local superintendent, an ISD superintendent. Now I'm in this role. And I just know that this isn't the system we would invent if we started over. We wouldn't have 500 school districts and 56 ISDs and all that. So to me, it's two things. It helps us get ahead of things like the dissolving districts. It also, if you're a big supporter of neighborhood schools, and I am, we're not going to protect neighborhood schools if we don't have an infrastructure around it that's more efficient. And, you know, a regular school, it doesn't necessarily care whether its payroll or its transportation comes from, you know, its local district or its intermediate district. They just want to be served. And that you can save hundreds of millions of dollars if we go to a system, a hybrid system, where we still keep the local district, but we move more of the services up to the county level.
What do you say to administrators, teachers, families, especially in those smaller districts, who fear a loss of control or who fear being swallowed up by some bigger countywide system?
Well, I mean, first of all, they control their ISDs. The ISD board members are elected from local districts, so they should be in charge, and this would maybe make them more cognizant of being in charge. But the second thing is, you know, when I was a local soup, it's been 20 years now, but we would spend all of August getting ready for buses and food service. We didn't do anything getting ready for the learning to speak of. You were so obsessed with the logistics of getting a district going. This takes that off their plate. The county's more efficient. You know, there's some counties that only have two districts. So you put those districts together for consolidation of services, they're still much, much smaller than, let's say, Okemos. And then you have some that maybe are a little too big. Maybe it couldn't all be Wayne County. Maybe there need to be divided up a bit. But the bottom line is that you don't need 30 transportation supervisors in Wayne County.
How do you respond to people who fear significant job losses?
You know, I admittedly, that's the biggest downside to this. I think by phasing it in over 5 years, which my proposal to the legislature has called for, retirements would be taken into account. I think this could be done in a sensitive way. And it doesn't even mean it has to be fully, they have to work towards a plan that would get this done in 5 years. But I'm not naive. I mean, you don't save what a couple of studies have said is in the neighborhood of $300 million. You don't save that if you're not losing some jobs in there. But I'm the chief educator, and if I put my educator hat on, I've got to be concerned about the kids in the classrooms more than the adults that serve the classrooms. And so I'm sensitive on the one hand to trying to make sure that those things are taken into account, but we can't just be living in the past. This is not the system we would have invented. And again, in my ideal world, we would be county systems, but that's not going to happen here. There's not the political will. So that's why I'm proposing a hybrid, which is still keep your local district, let the local district and local schools focus on learning, and let the county or the ISD or some other regional place think about the logistics of all those things, payroll, personnel issues. You know, educator evaluations is a big thing now that the lame duck folks put into law, and I'm basically supportive of that, but we don't really have a fair system in place yet on how to measure teacher effectiveness. So that's going to take a lot of work. I'd rather have a local district building and district supporting that than supporting bus routes.
Some number of skeptics say there's a lack of research to show that these proposals would work. William Mays, executive director of MASA, the Michigan Association of School Administrators, says, and I'll quote here, "It deserves careful research into whether or not it would result in significant savings." Do they have a point there?
You know, Bill's a friend of mine, but no, I don't think they have a point. You know, it doesn't take rocket scientists to figure out that there's efficiencies that can be built in here. And there are studies to show $300 million could be saved. Now, in fairness to Bill and that whole group that are, you know, cautious about this, they do need to be able to show their membership that this makes sense and why. But we're going to provide that. We're having hearings. I think they start. I think Representative Rogers called me today, and I want to say it's August something or other, there'll be the beginning of hearings on this. I'll be at the first hearing to make our piece. And this does deserve debate. You know, folks should weigh in on this. But I'm going to keep pushing because it can't just stay the way it is. It can't. In my ideal world, we'd add resources. I mean, we need more technology. We need lower class size. It takes resources. If I had my way, we would tax services, for instance. But that's not my job. You know, I'm not the legislature. I think, you know, I'm always troubled that a poor family pays taxes on a winter coat for their kid, but folks don't pay taxes on a game of golf. There's something wrong here. But I've gotten better in my 8 years here. I'm only doing two more. In trying to figure out what can I have an impact on and what my rhetoric may mean nothing. So I do believe we should tax services. I do think we should have more resources, but I have to leave with the reality that we aren't doing that. And as long as we aren't, we got to look for other ways to accommodate the needs that kids have.
We're talking with State School Superintendent Mike Flanagan. Other states have pursued this countywide approach. Florida, Virginia, and Maryland are three. What do you glean from their experiences?
Well, you know, I have friends in Lee County, Florida, and they still have, it's not like you totally eliminate all the layers. I mean, they're a county system, so they have one superintendent in that case. We're not calling for that, by the way. We're talking about a hybrid. But just to speak to Florida, they have one, but they also have assistant soups and regions, and they have, you know, a couple of transportation regions. So it's kind of quasi centralized. But again, I'm proposing a hybrid where we would still keep all the entities in place: 4,000 schools, 500 districts, 50 ISDs. But more and more of the services need to go up to the ISD for these efficiencies. So we wouldn't be a model like Florida. I have to admit, you know, when I first met with the legislature on this, I thought that's the way to go, but I'm not stupid. I've looked around and there's no way we'll get the votes to do that. And you know what? Maybe that is too much in the short term. But I there's some counties that could happen tomorrow. As I said, I think it's Branch has three or four school districts. You put them all together, they're not nearly as big as Okemos or Wayne Westland. So there's a way to do some of this over time. I really applaud Ypsilanti and Willow Run getting together and consolidating on their own. I would continue to encourage that. But this is another way to handle it. It's move more of the services up, not just to save money, but so that the schools could focus on learning.
The Snyder administration has made clear it feels that streamlining and consolidation of services, of units of government, should be a priority. Do you feel it's going to be easier to persuade Republicans to get behind this plan than Democrats?
You know, I've advised both Governor Granholm and Governor Snyder in this job, and I'm independent of them, but I work at working well with them. You're not going to get things done if you don't work well with a governor. You don't always agree. You know, I wasn't with him on the right to work stuff at that time. But having said that, the Snyder administration will be very good on this. They get that. I think both Republicans and Democrats get this. I think it'll be harder for some Democrats to support this as vocally as maybe some Republicans because of the constituents. Having said that, let's just generalize. I'm being stereotypical here, but let's say the average Democrat is concerned about some of the unions. This doesn't take away anything the unions are doing. They're still going to bargain locally and all that. And if anything, I'd want to make the argument to the MEA and the FT that there'll be more money available to the system in general. I mean, I'm the guy that called for $100,000 teacher salaries a while ago. We'll never be able to afford those, if ever, but never if we don't start getting economies of scale. So, you know, my job will be to try to persuade, in this case, maybe Democrats, that it's really in the interest of their constituents. And then I hope, you know, Mark, I hope in the final analysis, people will just take a deep breath, step back and say, what do our kids really need? They need support in 100,000 classrooms. It's less important to them who's running the bus system or who's running the report card system and all that.
That was State School Superintendent Mike Flanagan talking with me earlier today at his office in downtown Lansing for Current State. This is 90.5 WKAR. We are broadcasting Current State live all this week from the Common Ground Festival in downtown Lansing. A solid opening last night at the opening night of the event, and tonight Creedence Clearwater Revisited, and we've got a lot of people ready to go despite some rain showers that have plagued us here for the last couple of hours. Lansing Community College has gained national acclaim in recent months for its program that trains military medics to continue their careers after their discharge. LCC's Military Medic to Paramedic course is designed to help veterans who were previously denied college credit receive civilian certification. In the 18 months since its first class, Lansing Community College has attracted applicants from across the country, and in April, LCC was recognized at a White House forum as a national model. Joining me to talk about the so-called MM2P program is Lisa Ferris McCann. She directs LCC's Basic Emergency Medical Technician program. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, thanks for joining me.
And also Margie Clark of LCC's Health and Human Services Division. She is dean of that division. Hi, Margie.
Hello, Mark. Thank you for inviting us.
Sure. It's a pleasure to have you both here. I did a story on the launch of this on WKAR a couple of years ago, so it's great to to catch back up with you. Margie, this program is still quite new. Remind us of the origins of it.
Well, I can tell you it started almost 12 years ago where a nursing program director was reviewing transcripts of a military medic coming in to the nursing program and seeing all of the health education that these veterans received and no college credit. Wow. And that really begged the question. And so from that point back in 2001, I'm going to fast forward up to about 2009, where we received some dollars from an earmark, $190,000, with some assistance from Senator Levin. And that money we put to use to develop this crosswalk to identify what is the accurate and right field in terms of taking the military medic to the next step in the health career. And we found that it was the paramedic.
And was that incumbent on the college to really stay with it and pursue this opportunity and
Absolutely.
Keep this in front of elected officials, that kind of thing?
Absolutely, because as I said, it was back in 2001 and we never lost sight of it. And in fact, between 2001 and 2004, we developed an advanced standing nursing program that took paramedics, licensed practical nurses, and respiratory therapists to complete the RN in 11 months. But what we didn't lose sight of is the military medic, and we needed and knew we needed to bring them in because they were a critical component of someone who is highly trained, highly educated, and under-credentialed. And therefore, what we did is studied their curricula in the armed forces and found three matches in the armed forces. In the Navy, we found the corpsman. In the Air Force, we found the pararescuer. And then in the Army, it was the 68 Whiskey that allowed us to compare their curricula to the paramedic and found this match of 40 to 60%.
Very interesting.
When we did that, we found, hey, this is an opportunity to get them to the paramedic in 6.5 months.
Lisa, how is the program going?
Oh, it's going very well. We have an entrance class coming up of 40 candidates, and we have another one that's filling very quickly in June of 2014. I suspect another 40 candidates there as well. But the interesting part about this program is that it gives those military medics the credentialing that they need to get into the job market. Because, you know, as you know, Mark, unemployment among veterans right now is 28%. Mm. And so now we can get them into the job market. They can stack another degree on top if they want to continue with their education. But here's an entry point. And here's an entry point to make a good living and still continue their education on into other fields of healthcare.
Now, are you competing with other community colleges or other schools that offer any similar kind of program, or is this really unique to LCC?
I am very proud to say that we're the leader here. There really isn't another program in the country that is like Lansing Community Colleges, and we could not do it without the support of folks like Senator Levin and Secretary Volrath and those folks who have come, put their time and their energies behind our program to get it going and get it up and running. And it's just amazing how the family that kind of keeps you going.
That's great. How many have you graduated?
We've graduated 15. And those were two pilot programs. We deliberately kept them small because it was new ground for us. And we wanted to make sure that we kind of worked the kinks out and got everything set so that the incoming classes that are coming now forward at 40 apiece will benefit from those pioneers and those trailblazers and the lessons that we have learned.
How much of these veterans who apply for the program, Margie Clark, how much do they know, like what percentage do they know in order to get the degree? Do they know, is it 20%?
It's actually,
can you generalize there?
We've actually been able to map it out, and they have 40 to 60% of the knowledge of a paramedic to sit for that licensing exam through their military experience already. And they leave the military without a credential, so they can't work. Mm. And this program, as Lisa had mentioned, is what's so unique about it is we're giving them college credit for what they have already learned.
Yes.
And we're evaluating it through a competency-based evaluation with a cognitive exam over 2 days so that we can prove that they have the knowledge of what we're going to give them college credit for on their transcript.
This is called an experiential learning credit.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And I'd like to add that when we developed this program and with these small pilots, what we learned is we needed wraparound services to really embrace the veteran as they entered LCC. So beyond this program, we have a veteran services area in our student services, which is focused on bringing the veteran in, getting them transitioned into college life, which is very different from being in the military where you follow directives as opposed to being an independent autonomous learner.
But you're saying that formed around this initiative.
Yes,
is
absolutely.
That right? Okay.
And it helped us see what we needed to do for veterans coming in.
Excellent.
And our Board of Trustees recently supported an initiative for us to expand our program. So we are expanding to the 40 in the fall. So this is all, it's all good news for us, not only here at LCC, but for the veterans. The bottom line is they can be educated and working within 6 months, 6.5 months. They can enter a nursing advanced standing tract and within 11 months complete an associate degree in nursing. While they're in that associate degree of nursing program, they're actually concurrently enrolled in a bachelor's completion program.
Now, you've had 15 graduates so far. Do you have some kind of feel for what these folks are doing? Are they getting right into the workforce, or are they sticking around for the additional education? Is there a pattern there yet?
They're doing both.
Okay.
We have graduates that have gone to Physician's Assistant School. We have graduates that have gone into the Advanced Track Nursing Program. We have some that are staying in the field. But what we are most proud of is that every single one of them was offered a job before they finished their internship. So they got out into the field to do their internship, and our employers in the area were so impressed with their skills and abilities that they offered them a job before they even had a license. So I think we're onto something here.
Really exciting. Wow. Talk about the national shortage of first responders, Margie.
It's significant. And, you know, often you'll hear a lot about nursing and physician shortages. Of course, nursing is the largest healthcare professional group, so we hear a lot about that. But that shortage extends to all areas of the healthcare in terms of the paramedic first responder. It will take, the shortages are even present with paraprofessional roles, nurse aide, respiratory therapist, radiography, and it continues up to every hand that touches the patient. We have a national shortage in all fields.
You mentioned the services. The services that accompany that you've started for these veterans, have you delved into measures to address PTSD or any of the trauma that a lot of veterans have?
Oh, absolutely. All of the faculty members that teach in the military medic program are all former military. And that creates a bond very quickly with the students because they speak the same language. Additionally, the wraparound services that we have, the college, we're beginning to look at referrals and working with the VA to help the folks that need to have someone reach out to them. And when they get into the civilian college life here, sometimes it becomes a little difficult for them to reach out and say, I need to talk with someone. And so we're very selective in that the faculty that we put in there, that they would be able to recognize that and they might talk to them a little easier. And it has worked. We have had a couple that we've been able to refer to and get them, you know, keep them going.
That's a really great success story. I lost my train of thought here. We're surrounded by just enough stimulation here. It's very easy to get distracted at Common Ground. Does the program, here's what it was. It was, does the program still feel like a pilot program, Margie? Or do you feel like you're coming into your own with this thing?
Absolutely not. We are no longer a pilot. We are seated in what we need to do. We were able to do that through our first class and our second class to determine what needs to be added or deleted. And we're finding the skill set of these individuals to be very high. And at this point, what we may find is we may be able to award more experiential credit. And so each cohort that comes through, we're going to be able to determine where is that set. And we like that it provides a range, because in that range, these veterans that come in, if they gained a skill outside of perhaps their job duty in the military, we can provide an opportunity for them to show us that they have the knowledge, and we can give them credit beyond what we've even scripted at this point.
How about that? Really cool. Margie Clark is Dean of LCC's Health and Human Services Division, and Lisa Ferris McCann directs LCC's Basic Emergency Medical Technician Program. We've been talking about the MM2P program at LCC. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. All this week, we're coming to you live from the Common Ground Festival at Addato Riverfront Park, where there's a lot of rock and roll and there's a lot of country and a lot of hip-hop planned for this week. Garages are the traditional place where budding rock stars learn their craft. For 5 years now, there's been an alternative place where young musicians can learn from the pros. The Michigan State University Community Music School is offering a rock camp this week, and their work will pay off with their performance on Saturday night here at the Common Ground Music Festival in Lansing. The lead instructors at Rock Camp are the 5 members of the Michigan band Outer Vibe. They'll follow the Rock Camp Common Ground performances on Saturday with one of their own. Current State Scott Pohl visited the opening day of Rock Camp to hear how the kids are doing and to talk with Lisa Kakos and Jeff Brems of Outer Vibe.
Every hour glass runs out, every clock gets unwound. If you never get lost, you'll never get found.
five-piece alternative pop rock group, radio-friendly music. We're based out of Michigan, and we tour the U.S. and Canada, play 100-plus shows a year. Our band has a little bit of a different sound because I play trumpet in the band. We're not ska. It's still alt pop rock. So I play trumpet and keyboards, and I sing some backup vocals. And then we have the standard guitar, bass, Jeff plays the drums, and Sean sings lead vocals.
Tell me about why you do this. This is the fifth year of the camp. I'm not sure if you've done all five of them or not, but what motivates you to work with kids at a camp like this?
Well, you know, if nobody teaches the kids how to be a band, you're just going to end up with a subpar, you know.
You have to figure it out yourself.
Yeah, you have to figure it out yourself.
Take the long way.
And we did a lot of learning, and so we want to take what we learned and teach it to the kids. And, you know, it's something fun because we all teach lessons privately, and so just teach a rock camp together just made a lot of sense.
And the age range, I understand, is something like 11 to about 18, is that right?
Yeah, pretty close.
What kind of skill level do you find on day one? Today, as we talk, it's day one of the camp. What are you finding in terms of skill levels?
We required an audition for this camp, but it wasn't to make cuts. We just wanted to be able to actually kind of see the kids play before we met them, because we didn't. It makes it more difficult if we just see them on day one. It's like, okay, you're in a band together. I don't know who you are. I've never heard you play. So we asked for the audition simply to learn a bit about each camper before camp actually started. So there's no requirement really, other than they can already actually play their instrument a little bit. So we have beginners, we have people in the middle, and we have some people who are extremely skilled. And some of them are all in a band together. I mean, you never know.
If they came in as a band already formed, do you split them up for the purposes of this camp? How does that work?
No, if they came in as a full band and they wanted to even work on their own songs, we'd be totally okay with that. But that doesn't happen very often. And maybe they'll come in as a full band without a singer or without, you know, maybe one of the members can't do it. But we try to keep them together to learn performance tips and tricks and stuff.
All right, now rock and roll, we typically think guitar, drums, bass. Do we have any other instruments in the campers?
We have a couple keyboard players this time around. We usually get a few of those. Occasionally we'll get some horn players. We take a trumpet, saxophone, trombone sometimes too. So, because there are some old classic bands that have horns. So, and of course, because I play horn, I would always work with those bands a bit if we had it. But mostly, like you said, it'd be guitar driven.
So how many bands do we have? There are five of you, or are they split up into five groups?
No, we actually have eight bands. This year we added some helpers. So we have, our staff's pretty big this year, actually.
I think there are eight of us.
Eight instructors, eight bands. So, and then it's not like we all take one band and work with them. We'll all help all the bands. We float and we switch, and because we each have our strengths and our weaknesses. Like, I can't teach a guitar player the solo. I just, you know, I could sing it to him, but I can't teach him on the fretboard. So we all do our strengths pretty much.
Is this instruction about the music only, or do you have an opportunity to get into the business of making a livelihood as a rock musician, if that's what some of the kids are here for?
The best way to explain rock camp is we just call it a crash course in being a band. So a lot of it is rehearsal based, but that's not everything. So of course there's classes on music business. Today they took a marketing class. They named their band and they talked about creating a brand and, you know, where do you promote it? How do you promote it? They're going to take a songwriting class, write a song together as a group, and they're going to have a class, your classes on
rock history,
like all the legendary concerts and artists that inspire us today. And then we talk about how to book a show, like what happens after camp. How can you do it yourself? And so, yeah, it's rehearsal, but it's everything else along with it.
Do you see yourself in some of these kids back when you were that age?
Oh, totally. I mean, you know, as a drummer and a young drummer, you're just amped up, and most of the drummers are just amped up, and they just tap on everything and they hit their sticks, and then, you know, some of the guitar players are their characters, you know, and then so, you know, I see myself in a lot of the kids, actually, and so that's what makes it fun for me, and that's what makes it fun for all of us, because we were all young once and we all had the same dreams and aspirations, and we all kind of have the same, like, or we can see in the kids, like, the first day. Yeah, it's a bonding thing. The first day, they all kind of sit separate. They're like, I don't know if I know anybody. And then by the end of the day, or end of the week, you can't separate them. And it's just crazy town.
Who chooses the songs that each group plays? Do the kids pick the music themselves?
They do, but we have a, kind of a master list compiled of songs that we've chosen as a group. It's rock camp, but we try to include some pop, you know, some heavier stuff. And we've gone through a list of some of the bands, I guess, that you would say are a requirement. Like, you have to have some Zeppelin, you have to have some Hendrix, you have to have some Rolling Stones, some Lynyrd Skynyrd. But then we have newer stuff. We have, you know, oh, there's some Nirvana, there's some Red Hot Chili Peppers.
We have the new Imagine Dragons. Killers, Green Day, Foster the People.
We try to keep it current. I mean, the list changes a little bit every year, but by having a list, then that means that we can be prepared from day one. Like, we kind of have a limited list of songs for them to choose from, and then we can have the tabs ready. Like, oh, you want that song? Here you go. So that we don't have to say, oh, I don't know, are the lyrics appropriate for that song? It's too difficult, it's too long, how are you going to play that live? You can't really do Rush because...
You're not Rush.
I'm sorry. some of them, I mean, the music they listen to is... They have a huge range of what they listen to, but we just kind of have to put a filter on it because they have 5 days to practice before the gig, so...
And we know all these songs, you know.
Yeah.
So we don't want to, like, have to go ahead and learn these, like, crazy complicated songs just to teach them.
But then, yeah, we let them choose from the list. And we try to group them into bands based on what they like. So, I mean, as close as we can get with having never met many of them. So then, as a group, they can choose, and hopefully we don't have fist fights, which we haven't yet. So they're pretty open-minded.
Well, as an example, the group that I watched you working with was working on Foxy Lady, and then apparently earlier in the day, because they ran through it one more time, they did Blitzkrieg Bop.
Mm-hmm. That even do like a super old school song and then a really new school song, and those are both kind of old rock, old punk rock. So, and that's another thing, is we try to get those kids to in the same band with similar interests, so we don't have half the band just sad that they have to do this one song and they're unhappy. So a lot of times, you know, they'll pick pretty similar songs.
An important thing too is it's rock camp, and we want to try to teach them to open up their minds a little bit and maybe learn about some new music. And so we try to say, be happy with one of your songs. And if you don't like the other one, just try to accept it. And maybe you'll learn to like it and listen to what the other bands are playing. And I think a lot of them walk away with kind of a new outlook on some of the music they like. They learn to like some of the stuff I think they maybe didn't think they liked before. So that's cool, too.
The fifth year of this camp, have you heard from any of the former campers about whether they're still playing, maybe even still playing together?
I think some of the groups are still playing together. We've had rock camp groups stick together for years. And actually, we have some of our instructors who are assisting us this year are past rock camp students. And so they want to give back. It's a cool experience, and they like to be a part of it. And as far as being a band still, we've had probably three or four bands stick together for quite a while. We hear from a lot of the campers. You know, even if they don't keep their band going, they'll email us and say, hey, I'm trying to write a song. What would you recommend I do? Or, you know, could you give this a listen and give it a critique and maybe give me some suggestions? We do a lot of that, too. So they keep in touch with us.
Does going back to basics as an instructor help you as a performer when you're on your own playing gigs?
Yep.
Totally. I mean, it's because we practice all week, and then we preach and we preach, and then we have to practice what we preach on stage. And so, and that's actually a great part of performing with the kids. You know, we watch them perform, and then we show them that we actually do know what we're doing, and they go, oh, that's what it's supposed to look, you know, that's what they're talking about. So we try to use as many or implement as many techniques as we teach when we play.
So the campers get to hear Outer Vibe at some point this week, right?
Yes, they do. Sometimes we'll play a little bit for them when they ask during the camp, but sometimes we try to make them wait until the show at Common Ground. So they play. Our eight bands will each perform their two songs, and then they open for us. So as soon as they finish, we're like, all right, now it's our turn. Let's see if we know what we're doing. And then we'll play a short set after them. So, yep, they get to hear us.
Sounds like fun. You've got eight groups, each playing two songs, followed by a set by Outer Vibe. Should be a lot of fun on Saturday at Common Ground.
Mm-hmm.
Well, listen, thank you both very much, and good luck with this week's camp and with the performance on Saturday.
Yeah, thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thanks for coming.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Young bands from this year's Rock Camp will play at Lansing's Common Ground Music Festival here on Saturday at the GM Pavilion stage. Hear how this year's campers sound, plus a performance by Outer Vibe starting at 1:50 p.m. on Saturday. Coming up tomorrow on Current State from Common Ground, Lansing GM plant manager Tony Francovilla discusses local expansion plans. Also, Lansing musician Taylor Taylor. All that and lots more on Current State. We are here through Friday night live from Common Ground. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks as well to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Brad Walker and Andy Curtis for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.